I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. 1919, the Great War was over, the war to make the world safe for democracy, and prohibition was just being inaugurated. That would make the country, if not the world, a healthier place. And yet, the United States suffered some of the worst strikes and riots in history. It was a very insecure time. And writer and activist James Weldon Johnson called it the Red Summer. My guest is David Krugler, professor of history at the UW-Platteville and author of the book 1919, The Year of Racial Violence, How African Americans Fought Back, published by Cambridge University Press in 2015. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. It's a pleasure to be here.
What got you fascinated by this crucible of American history, that year 1919?
I originally set out to do a study of all of the problems that afflicted the United States after World War I. As you mentioned, there were strikes as well as all the racial violence that broke out. There were economic problems. The swift demobilization from World War I led to a lot of social problems. There was political upheaval. So I set out to study that. And as I began my research and reading, I quickly realized that that might be a project beyond what I could manage, and that perhaps it would be better to narrow my focus and find what was most interesting and most historically important about this tumultuous year. And that led me to look at the spike in racial violence against African Americans and, most important, their response to it.
Well, what was it about the Great War then? I mean, you mentioned the demobilization. But what was it about the war in terms of, like, demographic shifts and population shifts that caused this phenomenon?
Never before had the United States mobilized so quickly for such a massive military intervention or event. The Great War, as it was called at the time, was the biggest and most devastating war in human history. And the United States had managed to avoid direct involvement for almost 3 years, but in April of 1917, Woodrow Wilson asked the Congress and the American people to go to war against Germany and the other Central Powers to make the world safe for democracy. This is a significant part in the outbreak of racial violence after the war and the African-American response. Wilson justified entry into this war not just to punish Germany for violations of American neutrality, particularly shipping on the Atlantic, but it was his expectation, his hope, that an Allied victory with American participation could lead to a peace process that would forever remove the circumstances that lead to global war. That's why, for a time, Americans called this conflict the war to end all wars. By spreading democracy, by joining with other democracies, the United States, Wilson believed, would create a permanent peace, thus the war to make the world safe for democracy. The mobilization to enter the war after the Declaration was amazingly swift, and hundreds of thousands of men were drafted. Many more volunteered. The American Expeditionary Force was the greatest army the U.S. had ever fielded, and it was put together in less than a year.
Yeah, when you think about it, I mean, the war, if you look at one set of dates, 1914 to 1918, but that was in Europe, it's hard to believe that given the changes that it wrought, the United States was in that war for only about 18 or 19 months.
It's an amazing date to consider. And when you factor in actual combat involvement on the Western Front, it's a very short period. So from early 1918 through November of 1918.
So what happened when these troops came back?
They were coming back on transport ships to East Coast ports, Charleston, New York. They were being brought back in large numbers, one after the other. And discharged. And intimations of racial conflict were evident aboard the ships. I looked at files in the Military Intelligence Division records in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and found report after report from white Army intelligence officers expressing concerns about the conversations they overheard black enlisted men having. They reported evidence of radicalism and sedition. In their measure, this radicalism and sedition seems very innocent by our own viewpoint. These African-American soldiers were talking about looking for their equality, looking for their constitutional rights upon return. And this was of such grave concern to so many officers, they reported it to the Army's Intelligence Division.
The Army, of course, was segregated and would remain so for a good 30 years. And yet there were still conflicts between black and white soldiers? Or was this strictly a matter of the blacks feeling that they were not getting a fair deal in a more general sense?
It was both. So there was this growing resentment. And we should note that much of the anger and frustration African-American forces felt was due not just to the racial segregation they experienced while in uniform for their country, but also constant belittlement and racism, often in violation of standing Army regulations, white officers forcing black officers to eat with other black enlisted men, maintaining segregation even among the officer ranks. And violating protocol there. The French were warned that African Americans were a constant menace. That was the phrase used. This did not go unnoticed by black forces who wondered about the glaring contradiction between being drafted or volunteering to make the world safer democracy and then being subjected to continued white supremacy.
In terms of the bigger picture involving both whites and blacks when they came back to the United States in 1919, it would have been by now, the war ended in November of 18. What was the situation? World War II, after World War II, of course, there was this tremendous housing shortage and there was a tremendous readjustment in the labor market. What happened in 1919?
In 1919, the mustering out of so many troops, white and black, led to economic competition. And a good example of this is in Washington, D.C. A lot of white veterans drifted into Washington, some expecting to find perhaps government employment. But at the time, the government was shedding jobs. The rapid demobilization meant a lot of wartime agencies were no longer necessary or certainly didn't need wartime levels of personnel. Meanwhile, many African Americans had long worked for the government, the federal government in Washington, D.C. It's the capital's biggest employer. And there was a widespread view among many white veterans as well as white Washingtonians that African Americans should be fired from these positions, removed from them to make room for whites. So that leads to competition.
And so a little more detail on why were things different from the way they had been in 1916 versus 1919 in terms of the labor market? I mean, why couldn't the blacks returning from the war just resume the jobs they'd had in agriculture or, you know, labor in some form in most cases?
That's a great question. And before U.S. entry into the war, there had been some major social changes and demographic changes within the United States. It's in the mid-19-teens, so 1914 or so, that a large migration of African Americans takes place from the South to the upper Midwest and to northern industrial cities. It's called the Great Migration, and an estimated 500,000 African Americans moved north. They settled in cities such as Pittsburgh, Detroit, and Chicago. In Chicago, they took jobs that had previously been filled by recent European immigrants. The Great War all but shut down the flow of immigrants from European destinations to the United States. And then the mobilization for war removed millions of workers from across the country from those jobs and put them in the armed forces. So now there's this demobilization, the return of workers, and those jobs have been filled. And many of these cities that experienced the Great Migration had already had outbreaks of intense racial violence. East St. Louis, Illinois, is a prominent example. It was a major destination for Southern blacks. And in 1917, it experienced an outbreak of organized mob violence in which whites attacked African Americans. And one of the main causes was economic competition.
And presumably these blacks, these 500,000 of them, weren't interested in going back to the rural South.
Right. Few migrants returned. This was a permanent move for them. And many had been encouraged to move by northern black newspapers such as the Chicago Defender. Many realized that they would also experience segregation and racial discrimination in the north, but that circumstances would be less severe than in their hometowns in the south, and that there would be more opportunities even if there wasn't full equality.
So during that, we'll call it sort of the honeymoon period there of 4 or 5 years, did they fare better, those who went north?
It depends on where individuals ended up, but I would say as a generalization, yes, they found life in the north better. But for those who experienced intense racial violence in East St. Louis, one might say it was worse. But I think a really good measure of the difference can be found in letters that are widely available online, handwritten letters that many would-be migrants, black Southerners, wrote to churches or wrote to the Chicago Defender itself. They obtained copies of these newspapers, and we should note it was often difficult for them to do so because distribution of the Chicago Defender was often repressed in violation of the First Amendment throughout the South. But young people, teenagers, wrote letters asking for help, promising to pay back the money for a train ticket if they could just come north, and they detailed many of the harrowing conditions under which they lived, low wages, a form of slavery by another name, really, through sharecropping that didn't allow people to leave the land.
So it's a door that's closed, this life in the South. And 1919, troops, white and black, are pouring back into the northern urban areas. And there's just not room for everybody in the job market.
There was room for everyone. I think the issue was whether or not they would be welcomed as equal workers. And a good example of this is Chicago and its meatpacking industry, where a strike was being organized, where there was union activity in 1918 and in 1919. It's not so much that the packers were shedding large numbers of jobs. There was some. But the issue was letting black workers go first, while union organizers were trying to bring white and black workers together. And so those opposing forces created a volatile situation in which a lot of white workers believed blacks should be fired or should not be present at all, even if there was employment for them because of the needs of the employer. Meanwhile, these economic forces that are pitting large labor forces against owners and managers are reaching a high point of friction. This leads to a wave of strikes in the summer and fall of 1919, one of the most famous, the steel strike that swept across the country and led to shutdowns of mills in northern Indiana.
These strikes, though, were these biracial strikes?
No. Mostly not. The studies of the strike show that a lot of African American workers were wary of participating because they had been shunned by the unions and they wondered whether this was something that would serve their interests. That's not to say all African American workers didn't participate in the strike, but we should note that they were not welcome to begin with in the union, which led to a natural conclusion that perhaps this was not an activity they should be involved with. Employers also tried to intensify racial friction within their workforce by bringing in African Americans from outside of the state,
scabs,
outside of Indiana scabs, right, without telling them the situation they were coming into. And they didn't have access to a lot of news as we do today, certainly not the level of news to be aware on their own of what was going on. And in some cases, when imported African-American workers seen as scabs by the strikers came in, they said, I don't want to be a part of this. But this intensified friction. It was a deliberate move by a lot of employers.
So actually the employers were setting up a race conflict between white workers, unionized workers on strike, and black workers who were strike breakers.
Yes, and in some cases, employers hired private detective services in northern Indiana to create dissent and friction among European immigrants, to pit various hyphenate Americans or recently arrived immigrants against one another.
Where did the police stand in this conflict?
In the steel strike, the police were largely on the side of the employers. In Indiana, in Gary specifically, the situation became so volatile that federal troops were called in. And the commander of those forces, Major General Leonard Wood, saw it as his duty to not just restore order, but to take actions to reduce radicalism. Part of this was politically motivated. Wood had his eyes on the Republican nomination in the upcoming 1920 election. But Wood had also had recent experience putting down racial conflict and riots that had broken out in Omaha. And in fact, some of those forces were barely back from Omaha when they were being dispatched to Gary.
You mentioned politics then, David, and what about international politics' role in this? I mean, of course, the Russian Revolution has overthrown the Tsarist government, and there's this ferment between Bolsheviks and Mensheviks and all kinds of factions, white Russians versus red Russians, but it spills over and becomes an international phenomenon at this point, doesn't it?
Yes, very much so. This is the era of the Red Scare. So in addition to these strikes, there are a wave of domestic terrorist events in which radicals carry out bombings against targeted government officials. The most prominent example, an attempt to kill the Attorney General of the United States, A. Mitchell Palmer, by blowing up a bomb at his home in Washington, D.C. It's now known that the perpetrators were anarchists, and the bomber blew
another
himself
component.
Up.
Yeah. Anarchists, yeah.
The anarchist blew himself up on the doorstep, so A. Mitchell Palmer wasn't hurt, but it damaged his home. His children were there asleep. He was home, obviously a very traumatic event. And in all of that turmoil, it was easy to make the assumption that it must be these Reds who are responsible for this. They're trying to cause a domestic revolution. Anarchists don't have and didn't have much use for communists and vice versa. But in the heat of the moment, those distinctions were lost on a lot of people.
Well, I know that you have quite an interest in the Red influence or lack of it in some cases in this country as it carried on well into the 1940s. You certainly get into that in your novel, The Dead Don't Bleed. But how much international involvement, how much, if you say, Bolshevist involvement was there this early 1919 in this country?
There was notable involvement. The Union of Russian Workers, there was an organization of Russian workers that brought together Russian immigrants and industrial workers. They were devoted to communism. There was also the International Workers of the World, the Wobblies, founded in 1905. They were active in some of these strikes. And they were trying to foment revolution in the United States, bring about an international revolution. The Comintern was formed in 1919, so seeking to spread international revolution and bring communist groups together. That said, we should note the vast majority of striking workers were not interested in furthering communism or collapsing capitalism, but rather securing a safer and better compensated place for themselves in the industrial economy.
But if you're talking about organizing strikes and participating in strikes, then it becomes kind of a flashpoint for all these other suspicions.
Right. And in the case of the steel strikes in northern Indiana, the main organizing group was a traditional union effort, not led by communists. The smaller and much less influential communist groups were active in the strike, but they were participating for their own purposes. This put African Americans in a very difficult position. If we look at Gary, for example, which was not a huge destination for Southern blacks, but still a destination during the Great Migration, it puts a difficult choice before them. Do they join with the union effort? Do they join with the strike and possibly, very likely, lose their jobs? And do they join with an organization that has already showed enmity toward them? Or do they seek to continue about their lives and work as they had before the striking and go to work and subject themselves then to violence? And in Gary, African-American workers who tried to go about their jobs, those who were already in place, not people being brought in by the employers to create additional friction, found themselves being targeted by the strikers and being attacked. And this led them to defend themselves in many instances that I detail in the book 1919, The Year of Racial Violence.
And we'll look further at that year of racial violence and what America was like in that year of 1919 when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with David Krugler, and we're looking at 1919, a fascinating and in some ways horrific year in U.S. history, one that for a variety of reasons was fraught with racial tensions and violence. And we talked about the labor component of this and the competition between whites and blacks coming back from World War I, David. But if you look at these conflicts, the racial conflicts, they're not just in big northern cities. They're in rural parts of the South as well. So what's triggering these?
If we look at one of the most horrific outbreaks of racial violence in 1919, we go to Phillips County, Arkansas, the Arkansas Delta, where there had been a lot of economic change in the war years and before, with a lot of sharecropping underway, and a lot of sharecroppers trying to bolster their position and seeking better compensation for their toils. By this point in the Arkansas Delta and elsewhere in the United States, sharecropping was essentially a form of debt peonage in which the landowners rigged the books each year to permanently mire their tenants in artificial debt.
Like the company store.
Right.
A good device for that.
Tenants who tried to leave were subjected to the legal system, to the police, the authority, sheriffs given orders to find these individuals and literally drag them back to the land to pay off this debt that was unfair and inaccurate. The war years brought higher prices for cotton because of war mobilization, and it also brought a labor shortage. Seeking to capitalize on these advantages, black tenant farmers in Phillips County hired a white attorney from Little Rock, a guy named U.S. Bratton, to represent them and to seek a fair compensation for that year's harvest. They also formed a union that was organized by an African-American man named Robert Hill. When the planters learned of both measures, they undertook a variety of measures to obstruct the tenants' quest for economic justice and fair treatment. They used special deputies from the Missouri Pacific Railroad, so essentially private police as well as sheriff's deputies, to monitor the union meetings and in late September 1919 carry out an attack on a small church at a crossroads called Hope Spur.
Why a church?
Well, the church was being used as a meeting place for the tenant farmers. It was a very, you know, rudimentary one-room wooden structure. It was a dark area, just a crossroads along the tracks. But the planters and the private army essentially working for them, these police forces, were aware of the meeting. We're not sure how the altercation broke out. We do know that the tenants were armed and prepared to defend themselves. A shootout ensued. When news reached Helena, the county seat, and other areas in Phillips County, the sheriff, Frank Kitchens, organized posses, which set out across Phillips County, essentially hunting down African-Americans seeking to destroy the union, to obstruct any legal efforts. This resulted in the arrest of U.S. Bratton's son and his imprisonment, and to terrorize the majority black population of Phillips County so greatly that they would never seek to undertake such measures in the future. Subjected to this violence, the tenants fought back as best they could. In some cases, they were joined by returned black veterans of the U.S. Army. but they were outnumbered and outgunned. Furthermore, the governor of the state authorized the sending of white infantry troops to Helena, and there's a lot of documentation to show that those troops themselves joined with the posses to round up African Americans and to kill many. The estimates of the dead range from 25 to 237. This is a very recent estimate that's been tallied by the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama.
Any legal repercussions of that? I mean, how did the federal government respond, if at all?
There was an amazing and very important legal outcome. A dozen of the sharecroppers were put on trial and hastily convicted after being brutally tortured to extract false confessions. In some cases, jurors were members of the posse, and the trials were taking place one right after the other. In some cases, the Elaine 12, as they were known, Elaine is one of the towns in Phillips County where a lot of the violence was centered. In some cases, they were being brought into court in chains, and they had inadequate defense counsel, and they were swiftly sentenced to death. Their lives were eventually saved, though we should note that at many, many points during the next several years, their executions appeared imminent. Their lives were saved by the efforts of a black attorney from Little Rock named Scipio Jones, who represented them, as well as by the NAACP, which at first hid its involvement because it was worried about the backlash of this northern civil rights organization becoming involved in this legal proceeding. But the case that reached the Supreme Court was entitled Moore v. Dempsey, and in it, the Supreme Court ruled that state judicial proceedings have to ensure fair trials and equal protection, just like federal proceedings. Now, that might seem very remarkable to us. We would think that would have always been the case.
Right.
But it had not been constitutionally settled, not even after the constitutional changes that followed the Civil mm-hmm. War. So this decision essentially saved these men's lives and established an extremely important legal precedent.
Pull back a little bit for even bigger picture. Woodrow Wilson is the president. What kind of thinking did he have? What kind of policy did he have regarding race relations?
Wilson's views were very Southern. He was a racist, like so many whites of the era. I mean, we have to put this in the historical
context.
So it's
a relative term,
right.
too, of course,
right.
but yes.
I mean, he was a protector of white supremacy, and we tend to think today of white supremacy as something on the fringe and as practiced by hate groups. But white supremacy was the law of the land in the United States. And I'll just offer one brief example and bring it back to Wilson. Despite the ratification of the 15th Amendment, which guaranteed all men the right to vote regardless of race, color, or previous condition of servitude, throughout much of the United States, certainly where the majority of African Americans lived, that right had been stripped by the 20th century. And Wilson had no problem with that. Wilson was a constitutional scholar, an expert on Congress, a professor and university president before
PhD.
He entered political life. Right. But this contradiction didn't bother him because he believed in the alleged racial inferiority of African Americans. He accepted the scientific racism of the time. And we see this in his policies. Upon becoming president, he supports efforts to purge African Americans from the ranks of the civil service in Washington, D.C.
What was his rationale for that, that they would not be as effective as white incumbents?
His rationale was that these were not jobs they should have.
Uh-huh. They just were not constitutionally, no pun intended, qualified.
Right. It was better that whites fill these jobs. And so there was a reduction in the ranks of African Americans in the civil service in Washington, D.C. During World War I, it took a lot of lobbying on the part of prominent black leaders to get the president to speak out against the spike in lynchings that occurred during the war, with the vast majority of these lynchings directed at African Americans. Such use of violence by mobs to punish African Americans for asserting equality or defying any mode of white supremacy had been growing since the 1890s, but they were increasing during the war. And it took a lot of lobbying to get the president even to deliver a speech against this. And this is really the only public thing he says. When there's an outbreak of racial violence in 1919, 10 major episodes of anti-black collective violence, the president's response is to state that this embarrasses the United States before the world because the United States should be seen and always has been seen, the president asserted, as a model of democracy.
Right.
That statement overlooked the fact that the reason these episodes of attacks on African Americans were taking place was because African Americans were seeking their just and due place in democracy and were being denied by organized white mobs of private citizens, in some cases mobs that included active duty or recently mustered out service personnel and a variety of police.
Regarding this conflict between management or, let's say, ownership and labor, was there ever anybody on the management, on the ownership side who said, well, yeah, they have a point. We'll give them another 10 cents an hour or some kind of, you know, recognition of this problem?
Not that I came across in my research. I'll introduce another example, another one of the 10 major episodes of racial violence that African Americans fought back against. It's the last episode in 1919. It occurred in Bogalusa, Louisiana, which was very much a one-company town where a lumber company essentially was the major industry. Workers, black and white, lived in company housing and purchased their household items at the company store. There, the union effort was biracial and terrified that the workers might unify and overcome racial tensions. The ownership hired a private army to break up union meetings, to carry out attacks, and to target the leaders of the union, white and black. And three of them were killed in a shootout that occurred.
I'm wondering, it's a little early, but maybe not completely, where somebody like Henry Ford would have stood in this issue.
Henry Ford was seeking to minimize union activity up in his factories. In the 1920s, he would introduce the $5 day wage scale, in which workers were well compensated for their work, but in return for agreements about how they would live and to not join unions and to open their homes to inspectors to make sure they were living the way Ford and his managers wanted them to do. So that's a prominent example in the 1920s of an employer raising wages in order to appease workers and also better compensate them, but also to avoid increased union organization.
Yeah, so in a sense, with that, actually in a very real sense, with that increased standard of living came increased control over the lives of the workers.
Right.
These riots, north and south, then they become, I gather, less a matter of labor and more just a matter of race then. They kind of settle down into a simpler conflict base.
Yes, I think economic competition shows itself in many of these episodes of racial violence, but there are other factors as well. In Chicago, for example, the Great Migration had brought Chicago's so-called Black Belt, a neighborhood on the south side where African Americans, through a variety of measures, were forced to live, had brought it to the bursting point. And by 1918, 1919, more and more African Americans, especially those of means, were seeking to purchase homes or rent homes outside of the Black Belt, seeking to move to less crowded neighborhoods and find a more pleasant environment for themselves and their children. The segregation of Chicago was enforced through real estate practices, through violence. And when an altercation in late July on the shore of Lake Michigan led to fights between whites and blacks, Chicago's week-long riot really developed from that because of efforts of white gangs to drive out African Americans from the borderlands between the Black Belt and ethnic white neighborhoods such as Bridgeport and Canaryville.
So in terms of enforcing these racial divides, zones such as the Black Belt, that had to be part of the concern that if we give these black workers more money for what they do, then they'll want to buy into our neighborhoods and mix with us.
That's a factor, but the decision-making is split, right? Because the people who are concerned or don't want African-Americans living next to them, they're not the people who make decisions about their wages, right? Those are the bosses who live outside of the working-class neighborhoods.
Outside of both neighborhoods,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the one of the prominent gangs targeting African-Americans, Reagan's Colts, was a political organization that served as muscle for Frank Reagan, who was a prominent Democrat official in Cook County in Chicago. And they also saw their duty as one of maintaining all-white neighborhoods. So a lot of the participants in the violence, these young men in these gangs, they don't work at the stockyards, but their fathers do, or their fathers are police officers. And so they take it upon themselves to drive African Americans out to keep the neighborhoods all white. That involves targeting African Americans who work at the packing houses. And a lot of the attacks on African Americans, and we should keep in mind, 23 African Americans died in Chicago's week-long violence, as well as 15 whites. So a death toll of 38, a high one in an already high year of deaths due to racial violence. This brought about an intense effort of self-defense on the part of African Americans. The men of the 370th Regiment, 93rd Division, they had belonged to the 8th Illinois National Guard, a segregated unit, an all-black unit. They were one of the four regiments of African Americans who saw action in the Western Front, who weren't forced into service roles in labor battalions. And many of them had distinguished themselves so well in combat that they had received the French Croix de Guerre, the Cross of War.
Sure.
And we should note that the reason they received this French Medal of Honor was because they had been assigned to the French Army. They were the only American units put under French command. Woodrow Wilson and General John J. Pershing had resisted French and British calls to place a large number of American forces under their command. The French and British were seeking to use American forces as reserves, but Pershing, backed by Wilson, said absolutely not. American forces will remain under American command. But to appease the French, they were given four units, and it was only all black units given to the French. Pershing said race had nothing to do with it, but it's hard to believe that given the decision made. So these were combat veterans who put on their uniforms in Chicago and took up arms to protect African Americans from the attacks of the white ethnic gangs because the police were so overwhelmed. And in some cases, as I document in the book, police were aiding the white mobs.
Right, a phenomenon that we have seen before. What was the outcome of those conflicts in which you have these uniformed black veterans protecting blacks against white attacks?
One of the interesting outcomes is the differing coverage in the press. One thing I try to do in the book is to show how African Americans resisted in three main ways: through armed self-defense, as we see in the case of the men of the 370th, through efforts to correct misleading or outright factually false accounts of the racial violence and the response in the mainstream press, and then legal battles to secure fair trials and outcomes for those who were arrested and often falsely accused in the aftermath, as we saw in the case of Phillips County, Arkansas, with the Elaine 12. In the case of the men of the 370th, a quick survey of newspapers such as the Chicago Tribune or the Chicago Daily News, with predominantly white readerships, shows marauders. These men are described as wantonly attacking whites. One newspaper account even stated that they had fired on a police officer whose life was saved only by the bullet glancing off his badge, the star he wore on his chest.
Great symbolism there.
Outside accounts show that these men were not marauders, that they were not wantonly attacking white women and children and civilians, as these press accounts claimed, but rather they were trying to fulfill a police function. And this is what was emphasized in the black press. Because so few people in terms of the whole population of the United States actually witnessed these events, these press accounts, which were carried across the country, it's not just in the Chicago newspapers, but this coverage is seen in Washington and New York. It's out in the California
papers. Is it seen by whites? This is black press. Is it going to be read by whites?
It's not. So the NAACP undertakes a major effort to correct factually false stories in the white press in order to let all Americans know, particularly white Americans, but all Americans know what actually went on. And so an assistant secretary of the NAACP, Walter White, travels to Chicago and collects affidavits from a variety of African Americans to get reliable information about what happened, so that can be a factor in the court proceedings.
What kind of white participation is there in this effort to assist blacks in getting their message out?
There was some legal help in the case of the Elaine 12 in Phillips County. And there was white support for the NAACP. Some of its directors and founders were white. And in several instances, in the heat of the moment, at the height of the racial violence, there were moments where whites came to the aid of African Americans who were being attacked. There was a prominent example in Omaha, for example. So it wasn't a total backlash on the part of white Americans in every instance. But by and large, when we measure it, most white Americans either did not directly help African Americans or were active in targeting them.
We're going to look at how that year, that phenomenal year of 1919, played out in America when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with David Krugler. He's the author of 1919, The Year of Racial Violence, How African Americans Fought Back. And we're looking at that crucible year of 1919 in America. One thing that surprised me years ago when I first came across it was the burgeoning in the late teens and through the 20s of the KKK, which we think of as, of course, an outgrowth of the Civil War. And you don't seem to hear about it too much. And then suddenly it's everywhere by the time you get to 1919. What's the story behind that?
This is an example of the backlash in the United States against African Americans seeking equality and their constitutional rights. This movement on the part of African Americans had been building before the war. It's known as the New Negro Movement, using the language of the time. And it intensified during the war. And as I said at the onset of our interview, a war to make the world safer democracy was rhetoric and a principle that fed directly into African Americans' efforts to secure their place in democracy. And the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan across the United States after World War I is part of this response to say, no, we're not going to allow African Americans, we're not going to allow you to have your place in society. We're going to go back to the pre-war status of subservience and submission. And the war has not changed that in any way as we see it. And a good example of this attitude is seen in Pittsburgh, where the Ku Klux Klan was posting in 1919 warnings to African Americans not to seek their rights and said, quote, "The war is over," end quote. So there's a conscious recognition on the part of these KKK members that African Americans are using the war and their contribution to victory, their contribution to make the world safe for democracy, to secure a place for themselves. This is in Pittsburgh. This isn't in a southern city.
Well, of course, the Klan was very strong in Indiana also, and it was for a time, even in Madison, Wisconsin, fashionable to be in the Ku Klux Klan, whether you actually participated in any kind of violent or intimidating activities. It was fashionable, strangely fashionable from the standpoint of today. So in terms of the Constitution, First Amendment rights, obviously, you know, their expression, freedom to assemble and, you know, express themselves, obviously at odds with the establishment. Other constitutional aspects of this struggle where the blacks are really just trying to get basic constitutional rights for themselves?
Yes, as we discussed, the episode in Elaine, Arkansas shows efforts to secure fair trials, and the constitutional outcome of that is one in which state proceedings must meet the U.S. Constitution. So that's a major victory. The Second Amendment was also a battle for African Americans. And one thing I document in the book is the widespread campaign by the federal government, state governments, and local governments, and even private gun dealers to deny African Americans access to firearms.
And how constitutionally do they justify that?
At this time, in 1919, there are no court decisions that read the Second Amendment the way they are read today to allow for such purchases. So in Chicago, for example, and in many places of the South, there are local restrictions on gun purchases. But for a lot of the participants in this denial of Second Amendment rights to African Americans, it's not really an issue of law or the Constitution. It's just a matter of custom and practice. So I document many instances in which gun dealers were assuring state officials as well as representatives of the Bureau of Investigation, the forerunner of the FBI, that they were not selling firearms or ammunition to African Americans unless they had a note from a white man. That made it allowable. So there you see a vivid example of the practice of white supremacy. This also feeds into the second front, as I call it, that African Americans were fighting after World War I, the fight for the truth. If armed self-defense was the first front and the third front was the battle for justice in the courts, the second front was the battle for truth and accuracy about these episodes of racial violence, almost all of which were initiated by whites against blacks. If the narrative is that African Americans were to blame, which is what mainstream papers were saying one after the other, consider the example of Chicago where the black men in uniform defending their community were presented as marauders. If that's the narrative, then we can understand why the federal government, the state government says we have to deny African Americans, in their view, we have to deny firearms to African Americans because they're going to use them for an insurrection. They're using them to kill whites. It's for an uprising. This is conditioned as well by the bombings that take place, by the Red Scare, by the strikes, the upheaval. But I do want to emphasize that this was a false view. African Americans did not want firearms to carry out revolution or to target whites, but to defend themselves. And in the book, I provide example after example where writers in the black press say, get a gun. Don't go out and shoot someone. But if they, you know, if someone comes after you, to put it as one writer did for the Cleveland Gazette, make it hot for them.
Make it hot for them. What was the upshot of all this racial violence in 1919?
In the short term, there seem to be few gains for African Americans. There's not a restoration of the 15th Amendment voting rights. And when the 19th Amendment takes effect in 1920 and American women are now eligible to vote, there's disfranchisement of black women going along with disfranchisement of black men.
This disenfranchisement has effect through what, poll taxes or you know, written tests to prove proficiency in the language or intimidation or how does that take place?
Mostly intimidation, and there are many examples in 1920, a lot of them from Florida near Orlando, African Americans seeking to vote or urging African Americans to vote were targeted by the Klan, and there were numerous violent deaths of African Americans seeking to exercise their right to vote. In Jacksonville, Florida, black men and women lined up to vote were simply told they didn't have the proper documentation to register to vote, and that so there's intimidation, there's bureaucratic practices to deny it. In many of the court cases, African Americans unjustly charged with felony crimes when they were merely defending themselves spent a long time in jail. There were some notable victories in which acquittals or abandoned prosecutions were secured by attorneys. So that's a notable victory. But on the whole, in the short term, there's not a lot to see as a gain. But in the long term, I believe, the model and example of armed self-defense, of the fight for truth and accuracy in reporting, and the struggle for justice in the courts waged by African Americans after World War I, in the long run, results were seen. We see this in the Harlem Renaissance, which brings a cultural element and a literary and artistic element to the New Negro Movement.
Yes, quite a flourishing.
Right, right. We see this in the 1930s in legal struggles to secure fair trials for unfairly charged African-American defendants. And when the United States enters World War II, I think we really see the long-term results of black resistance to white violence showing itself. In 1941, a black union leader by the name of A. Philip Randolph, who headed up the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, organized the March on Washington movement, which promised to bring hundreds of thousands of African Americans to Washington, D.C. to march for their rights, to march for an opportunity to be fairly hired to work in the flourishing defense industries, even though the U.S. was not officially in the war. It was aiding the powers fighting the Nazis, and the Great Depression was coming to an end. But factories practiced the discrimination that had long been present. A. Philip Randolph styled this as an effort to to give loyal Americans their opportunity, a fair opportunity to do their part for their country. A. Philip Randolph had been active in 1919. In 1919, he was a socialist writer and leader, and he was a strong proponent of armed self-defense by African Americans if attacked. He was an editor and publisher of a monthly, a black socialist monthly called The Messenger. And in his editorials, along with his partner Chandler Owen, this is made clear time and time again. By 1941, Randolph has left socialism aside, but he's still fighting for racial justice. And I believe that the March on Washington movement, which was successful in getting President Roosevelt to issue an executive order against discrimination in federal contracts and in federal hiring, and the setting up of a office to ensure that that order was being met. I believe that Randolph's effort was conditioned and inspired by what he had gone through in World War I. Black veterans who serve in the armed forces during World War II, again, another war to make the world safer democracy and to put down Nazism, come back and say, we're not going to be subservient and subjected to racial violence and mistreated. And a lot of recent studies of the post-war civil rights movement has shown just how important black World War II veterans were in early efforts in the 1940s and in 1950s, well before the major instances of civil rights activity that are still so famous today, such as the Montgomery bus boycott.
Right. These things rarely spring forth without any kind of origin behind them.
It's, yes.
Sometimes a long development for what looks like a spontaneous effect. David Krugler, thank you for joining me for University of the Air. David Krugler is the author of 1919, The Year of Racial Violence, How African Americans Fought Back, and more recently, the novel The Dead Don't Bleed, set in 1945.
Thank you so much, Norman. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Look forward to your next visit, and I hope you'll join me for the next University of the Air.